Thank you, Sarah. You did an amazing job. Hi, everyone. My name's Bree, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bree. We love you, Bree. Lots and lots and lots.
It is my honor to introduce our speaker for tonight, what you guys have all been waiting for. I manifested this. I hyped for this guy. I'm so excited for you guys to hear his experience, strength, and hope tonight. And with that, I will give you Dave from Texas.
Perfect. Yep.
Where's my Esky Pop? I can't hear you. Pop, pop, pop. So, good evening. My name's Dave, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave. We love you. Awesome, awesome, awesome.
All right, you guys are my witnesses. You saw it, now it's coming off. I'm gonna try to give you guys a talk while I'm standing. I had spine surgery 3 days ago, on Wednesday, 2 days ago, I guess. So my back is a little jacked, so I might have to sit down. But like I said, my name's Dave, and I'm an alcoholic, and today, my sponsor, Jack, just had hip surgery. So keep Jack in your prayers, too. You know, when you get older, you fall apart. Getting old is not for the faint of heart. So what a wonderful, wonderful talk. I just love the Al-Anons. Just fantastic. They're our people. They're the only people that love us more than us. It's fantastic. You know, as I share my story, I'm going to be sharing my experience, strength, and hope. So if your recovery doesn't match mine, that's okay. But if I say something that kind of gets into your skin and sticks in your craw, fantastic. If it really gets you aggravated and upset, beautiful. Because that's telling you that there might be something there. Let's take a look at it. You know, we can go through it. I got raised in an alcoholic household, for what that's worth, you know, and it's one of those households that everybody knows if you got raised in one. Yelling and screaming at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, dad dragging mom down the stairs by her hair, you know, and the next morning there's always the standard apologies, you know, I quit, I'm done, you know, just watch, I'll change. And it was delusional. It never happened, right? Until dad got bad enough and he finally got into recovery. And one of the things that my father decided to do was by trade, he was an airline pilot, but he wanted to be a gentleman farmer. So he bought a farm out in northern New Jersey, and I was raised on that farm. Growing up on a farm and growing up in the household, it didn't take me very long to figure out that, you know, my dad would buy his beer by the case, you know, and he loved Ballantine Ale. If you guys are old enough to remember what Ballantine Ale is, I don't even think they make it anymore. But I learned as a little kid that if I brought out 2 quarts of Ballantine Ale after he was out plowing, he'd start on the first one and he'd give me a couple sips from the second one, you know. And the first time I had alcohol, I spent the rest of my life chasing that high, you know, that warm flush in your face and that little burn as it goes down and that just that sense, that feeling. And I spent the rest of my life chasing that in my drinking and drugging days. And when I was about 13, I guess, mom and dad decided to separate, and because dad's drinking got out of control. And what a horrible age for that to happen. You know, when you're 13, it messed with my head. And one of the things that I had to put the flames out. I could not stand that, you know, and dad had this beautifully stocked liquor cabinet and he had moved to Bermuda, and I figured he's not going to need it, you know? So I started tapping into his liquor cabinet, and it wasn't very long before I realized that wasn't going to last because I was drinking it too fast. And it was really difficult to get alcohol, but it wasn't difficult to get other substances. So I turned to those because that was easy. First time I got arrested for dealing, I was 13, twice when I was 14, twice when I was 15. Each time I'd get arrested, I'd have to do the walk of shame. My mom would have to come get me from jail. And my dad had lots of extracurricular activities. All of them involved drinking. He was a volunteer policeman and a fireman, and he was in the Lions Club. Anything, any group that had a lot of drinking, my dad was part of it, you know. And as a cop in town, everybody knew me, you know. And because my dad was a cop in town, they thought I came from a good family, so they let me go, you know. What really was going on was, from an Al-Anon perspective, they were enablers. They weren't letting me feel the consequences, you know. So when I turned 15, my older brother Bob turned 18. It was one of the greatest days of my life, because on his 18th birthday, I snuck into his bedroom and stole his driver's license out of his wallet. And until 9/11, New Jersey didn't have pictures on their IDs. And it was the perfect fake ID, because we're identical from description, same height, same hair color, same eye color. I know the name, you're not gonna mess me up on the address, and I'm gonna get the birthday right, even no matter how drunk I am. And so I took that ID and I started drinking in the same watering holes that my dad was in. You know, all those places when I was a little kid growing up, my mom would always say, who wants to go with your father? He's going down to the hardware store. And I would always volunteer, because that meant we're going to the bar, where we were going after the hardware store. And I'd get unlimited Shirley Temples, and my parents wouldn't let us drink any soda in our house. We had virtually no sugar. And I got really, really good at drinking Shirley Temples and playing that game with the sawdust. And it was like a bowling game. And I'd bet on that. I'd come home with pockets full of change, full of quarters, because everybody else was drunk. And I was sober, you know, as a kid. And those were my people. You know, everybody in there were my people. And they told the most amazing stories. It was a wonderful way to grow up. So when I was 15, I put down the other substances because I didn't want to get arrested anymore. And I started drinking. And it was great. And if you got caught drinking, they'd just let you go. It was not a big deal in those days. I'd love to say that I didn't drunk drive, but I know I did. I just didn't get caught. And when I was about 17, one of the really nasty things happened was Dad came into AA. Oh man, it was tough. Maybe it wasn't that old. Maybe I was 16. And Dad comes home and he decides that everybody's going to meetings. I was like, oh no, you got to be kidding me. So he drugged me off. And as my retribution, I got really hammered. And I went to an Alateen meeting. So I started 47 years ago in Alateen. Those were my first meetings, you know, and what a great place to start. And once a month in Denville, New Jersey, at that meeting, they had a open meeting where all of the groups came, the AAs, the Al-Anons, Alateens, and they even had Alatop would all show up and then have a celebration meeting. And so I got to be in an open AA meeting. And I realized that you guys are my people. I was going to end up with you guys one way or another. I was just going to push it as far as I could, and then I'd come in. It never occurred to me, because I was young and stupid, that I thought I was bulletproof, that maybe I wouldn't make it back. And I almost didn't. I came real close to not making it back. So it was time to go to school. You know, I graduated in the lowest quintile of my high school class. Anybody else like me, an underachiever? All right, there's my people. There's my peeps. Yeah. Basically, I was just out of it the entire time. I cut more days than I actually attended in school. And, you know, I'd be hitchhiking back to school, and Wandy Cox, the truant officer, a friend of my dad's, would see me hitchhiking down the highway. He'd stop and pick me up, and then he'd say, where are you going? I'd say, I'm going back to high school. He'd say, great. And we'd pull up to the high school. He'd go, front door or back? I'd go, back, please. He dropped me off at the – he was the coolest guy. He dropped me off at the back door. He had to know I was out of my mind. I must have smelled like a brewery. But, you know, he'd always drop me at the back door, you know, and I'd go in and I'd show up at the last class and I'd catch the bus home. So my parents thought I was at school all day. And really, I was out drinking all day. My brother Don was my drinking buddy. He was 2 years older than me. And the two of us hung out together. And when he went off to college, I was like, man, I guess I'm going to have to go to college. And in order to pick a college, I needed to get away from my dad. So I took a map and I stuck a stick pin on New Jersey. I drew a 2,000-mile circle, and I looked outside the 2,000 miles. And I said, that's where I'm going to go to school, somewhere outside. And I found a school in Arizona that would take you if you had enough money, because they sure didn't take me for my grades. And I went out there with my ID in my pocket. Drinking age was 18 in Arizona. and I could drink the way I wanted. My first semester, I got some B's, mostly C's. Second semester was all D's and F's. It took me 3 semesters to drink my way out of college. But something really strange happened. I became the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. When I would drink alcohol, this violent person came out. You know, all that stuff that I've been stuffing for all those years, you know, I always felt like I didn't get a playbook on life, that everybody else knew what life was about, and I was just different. I didn't understand what everybody was doing, so I'd kind of hide in the back, wait and see what was really kind of going on, and then I'd jump in and try to take the lead and be the, you know, the king of the mountain, you know, on the playground or whatever. It didn't matter. I'd try to race to the top, and because it was all about me, right? And in college, all of a sudden, I started drinking the way I really wanted to drink, and it didn't matter whether you're friend or foe. You know, when the beast came out, you were in danger. You know, I put some of my very good friends in the hospital, and I found that I had this penchant for bar fighting. Any other bar fighters in here? Yeah, there's my people, you know? And so I started bouncing at a bar, and to me, that was the only outlet. And when you let that beast out, there's that relief afterwards, but you feel really horrible about yourself because you hurt somebody else. You know, there's only one way to put those flames out, and that's to drink heavier. And after a while, it stopped working. You know, alcohol wasn't my problem. Let me say that again. Alcohol was not my problem. It was my solution. It worked for me. It made the pain go away until it didn't. And when it stopped working, when that bitch betrayed me, man, was I pissed. You know, it hurt. It really did hurt. I ended up in the hospital 3 times in the same month. Fighting was involved with all of them. The last time when I came out of the coma, and it's funny, God has a sense of humor. It was the same doctor that was in all 3 occasions that I ended up in the hospital, the Yavapai County Hospital. And this guy, I'd gotten into 4 fights. I'd won 3. The last one, the guy tapped me on the shoulder and sucker punched me and went down a set of stairs and landed on my face. And it crushed my skull. And my face was so busted up, if you kind of touched it, it would kind of slide across. All the bones were broken. And it was really pretty bad shape. And this doctor, I come to and I'm in an ICU, and he walks up and he grabs that little baby smock. And I said, "Hey, doc, how you doing?" And he looks at me and you could just tell something snapped in this doctor. He was so pissed off at me. He grabbed a hold of that little smock and he picked me up and he's shaking me. And he's going, "I'm tired of putting you back together. What is wrong with you?" And every time he'd shake me, the pain was excruciating. But it worked because it didn't click. Here's this guy who's supposed to be helping me and he's hurting the living hell out of me, right? And it snapped, you know? And so what I did was I picked up the phone and I called the man that I never would call, that I swore I would never talk to ever again. I called my dad. See, back on October 19th, my twin sister and I were born on my dad's birthday. So we had a triple header. And he'd flown the 2,000 miles on October 19th to take me out to dinner, he and my mom. When they showed up, I said, no, I'm not going out with you. You should have called and told me you were coming. I'm going out with my friends. We got a party tonight. And I went to the only really nice restaurant that was in town. And that was where my parents decided to go eat dinner. And I can remember to this day, standing at the bar, looking at my parents eating their birthday dinner by themselves. And my hand was in my pocket. And I felt that little ball of lint at the bottom line. And I thought, you are such a scumbag. How could you do that to your parents? I didn't have a choice. Alcohol owned me. I didn't draw a sober breath from October 19th until December 5th when I came out of the coma. Every single day was an absolute dumpster fire. I mean, I just drank as much as I could get. I had one of those little refrigerators right next to my bed. You know, I would pray that when I woke up in the morning that there would be a bottle in there or something, a half a bottle of beer. If there wasn't a half a bottle of beer, I'd roll out on the floor because I had DTs and I was shaking so bad. You know, I'd walk over and there'd be like a half a bottle of Michelob on the floor. I'd grab that sucker, take a swig out of it. I have to spit out the cigarette butt. Somebody dumped a cigarette butt in there. Down the hatch you go. Got to get a little hair of the dog because I couldn't hit the target in the morning, you know. And I developed this weird habit. You know, I'd be in blackouts and I'd be pissing in my roommate's closet and think, you know, and I thought it was funny. For some reason, they didn't think that was funny. You know, they told me I had problems, you know. So I crashed and burned and I go home. I fly back to New Jersey and go see a plastic surgeon. And my face was so busted, they had to put my whole entire head in a cast. you know, and it's really weird. You've got pictures of your face from the front, but you don't have any profile pictures. So he didn't know how to sculpt my nose properly. Anyway, he cast my entire head. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was truly anonymous because all you knew was my name was Dave and I had blue eyes. That was it. I was in a cast, you know? And my older brother, Don, had drunk his way out of college at Ohio State University about 2 months before I got home. So he started taking me to meetings to sober up. And that's all I knew. And that's all I'd seen my father do. You know, when my father got sober in 1976, that's all he did was he'd go to work or he'd go to meetings. He'd wake up at home. He'd look at his watch and go, "Up, there's an Eaton meeting." He'd jump in the car and he'd go to a meeting. If I wanted to see my dad, I either had to go with him to work or go to a meeting. You know, and that was one of my favorite things to do was get hammered and go to an AA meeting. You know, and everybody knew I was drunk, but they loved me unconditionally. It was the first place in my life that I felt like I absolutely belonged was in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you were the same people that were in the bars telling me those stories that I was drinking with for all those years. Now you're in these meetings and you're sober and they're like, "Come on in." It had been so long since I'd been asked to go anywhere that anybody wanted me for anything. And I just melted in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I knew this was where I was going to end up. And so I started going to meetings with my brother and I was a teenager. I got sober as a teenager in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can tell you that I literally grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were unemployable. One day this guy comes up to us and goes, "Hey, you guys got jobs?" We go, "No." He goes, "Well, you do now if you want them." And this guy, Carl, he became my sponsor. And he was a mason by trade, and everybody on his crew was in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so 6 o'clock the next morning, Carl's in my driveway, he picks me up. We have a meeting on the way to work, right? Because there's three of us in the cab of his truck. You know, we have a meeting on the way to work. At work, everybody in the crew's on, you know, is in recovery, you know? And so I'm hauling, because I'm big and I'm this young, stupid kid. So they're like, "Hey, haul the 18-inch blocks up the scaffolding." So I'm hauling the blocks, you know, and if I drop one on my foot, I'll be hopping around. They're like, "Oh, easy does it." You just want to drag them off the scaffold and beat them with an inch of their lives, right? And then we always took a lunch, you know, so we'd have lunch and we'd go, there's like 10 of us, we'd all go sit underneath the tree and we'd have a meeting for lunch while we had our lunch. And then we always finish on time. We'd have a meeting on the way back to the house and he'd drop us off and say, "I'll be back in an hour, get a shower, and we'll go to the meeting, go to the home group." You know, we'd have another meeting on the way to the meeting. We'd have the meeting. Then we'd go to the diner. We'd have a meeting after the meeting at the diner. Then we'd have another meeting on the way home. And he'd say, "I'll pick you up at 6. I mean, I didn't have time to go out and relapse. It was just constant meetings, you know? One day Carl looks at me and he goes, "On a really good week of yours, what's the minimum you would drink?" I said, "Geez, Carl, I don't know. I can't remember a day that I never drank at least a minimum of a 6-pack, you know?" And so he reached in his pocket and he pulled out a roll of dimes. And for you young people, there was used to things called pay phones, used to put money in to make a phone call. And he handed me this roll of dimes. He goes, "Okay, then I want you to call 6 people a day in recovery." He made me carry my big book with me everywhere and write phone numbers inside my big book so I could have these numbers to call. And of course, I complained and I go, "I don't remember reading that in the big book." He goes, "Oh, yeah, page 152. He goes, "What's the substitute for alcohol?" And I went, "Oh." So I shut up and I called 6 people a day. All these years later, I still make a minimum of 6 calls a day. The herd of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, will help protect you. But there's 2 things in recovery. A lot of people don't understand that. There is the program, which is the big book, the first 164 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is our program. And the fellowship, they're 2 distinct separate things. So you substitute the fellowship for your drinking. And since I was a daily drinker, I started doing meetings every single day. And I talked to alcoholics every single day. And Carl knew what he was doing. Bill Wilson, when he was in Towns Hospital, had a roommate that was there. His name was Delaney. He and his wife got sober and started one of the oldest rehabs in the United States up in northern New Jersey. And Geraldine was sponsored by Bill Wilson. Geraldine sponsored Betty. Betty sponsored Nelson. Nelson sponsored Carl. Carl sponsored me. So I'm like 6 generations away from Bill Wilson. So I got a pretty pure message. And it was all big book, straight out of the literature. And Carl said many things to me. One of the first things he said is, "Hey, kid," he used to call me kid or dummy. "Hey, dummy, don't ever let your sponsor kill you." He said, and I said, "What do you mean by that?" He goes, "Don't ever let anybody read your big book for you." So he would always put me to the book. he would share his experience, but it was always with what was written in the book. I didn't know any difference, so that's the way I learned Alcoholics Anonymous. So I work right out of the book. He gave me the wonderful keys to the kingdom. I got sober. My life started getting really fantastically better. I started doing construction during the day, full-time. I did masonry and I did excavation and became a diesel mechanic. And I went to night school and got my associate's degree. And then I went on to get my baccalaureate degree. Ended up going to Muhlenberg in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Most expensive education in the world. Because one day I get there, it's my senior year, right? I come back from summer and I'm going into my senior year and I'm walking across the campus and I see these two girls coming. And it's a small university. I know every girl on campus. And I'm like, oh, freshman, right? Fresh meat. So here she comes and she smiles at me as she's walking past. And literally, I'm all sweaty and I'm carrying this box. It's summertime. It's like late August. And I'm carried up to my room and I walked in and I said to my roommate, Fritz, I said, Fritz, I just saw the girl I'm going to marry. 38 years later, I'm still married to that woman. Happily married, right? But I did something I'd never done before. Because when I came in and I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a sexual predator. I did lots of 13-stepping. And I'll never forget, Jim McCabe, he pulled me aside one day and he goes, hey kid, I saw you looking at the girls. I'm like, oh yeah, do you see those girls over there? They're gorgeous. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I'm old and fat. He said, but don't think I won't get some of the young bucks that are in this meeting. We'll take you out back and kick your ass. You stay the hell away from the women. Stop trying to kill them. That's old school head. Of course, what did I do? I stopped going to Jim's meeting. I'm not that bully yet. But then I got well, right? And so the reason she's still my wife is because I knew her for about 5 minutes and I knew it's time to change my behavior. So I sat down and I told her my story when I knew her for about 5 minutes. I said, you need to know who I am before we start down this path. And she didn't go screaming for the hills. You know, she just sat there and nodded and she's like, oh, wow. And I had about 4 years of sobriety at the time. And she's like, wow, this is kind of cool. And her dad was in the same profession as my dad. Her dad was an airline pilot. I mean, basically I found somebody that I matched her dad. And, you know, she fell head over heels in love and I fell head over heels in love with her. And, you know, but I had this ideal from my four step, and most people don't realize, but there's five separate inventories in the four step. There's a resentment inventory, which focuses on forgiveness. There's a column four, question four is fear. So you have a fear inventory. You work on your fears. There's a sex inventory, 9 sex questions. And from those questions, you're supposed to create a sane and sound sex ideal, a written ideal. And I had a written ideal that described my behavior. One of the things that was described in my ideal is somebody who you won't sleep with on the first date, because I was a whore. That's what I did. I didn't want to get into a relationship with women. I just wanted to sleep with them. So I felt better. I was using it like I used alcohol and drugs, right? So here's this woman and I told her my story and I had this ideal and I'm like, I'm going to follow this ideal. And I got to know her. We became friends first, right? Before we ever started the shenanigans, the he and she and stuff, right? What a difference. Because our relationship was founded on the truth. It was founded on ideals that I learned through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the way, the last inventory is a harm done to others. If you weren't resentful at them, you weren't afraid of them, you didn't have sex with them, where do they go on the inventory to harm them? Harms to others inventory. Those are the five for the four step. So I've been given this gift and my life starts filling up with fantastic things. Now, when I was 5, I knew I was gonna be a pilot. I always wanted to be a pilot, right? And so I graduated college and I went to the military and I said, hey, I wanna become a pilot. And they said, one of those questions on the questionnaire, have you ever used drugs? I'm like, oh, how do I answer this one? Carl, like, it's an honest program. I'm like, yeah, it is an honest program, right? And another friend of mine, he's what a great wisdom he had. He used to always say this expression. It's one of my favorite expressions. The only problem with the truth is you get instant results. So I told the truth, right? I said, yeah, I've used drugs. And the recruiter's like, how long has it been? And I said, oh, I just had my 7-year anniversary. It's like, great, because anything under 7 is disqualifying. And the military took me. And they sent $2 million sending me to pilot training. I'm like, thinking, wow, how does that happen? You know, somebody with my background, and I actually can hold a security clearance. How cool is that? So I start flying for the military, and I start to get a job with the airlines, and I'm flying for the airlines, and my life is filling up with great stuff. What does an alcoholic do when their life starts filling up with great stuff? You stop going to meetings, right? I need some time. I got too much in my life. I don't need to go to that meeting. I got this, right? You ever notice that voice that tells you that you've got this is the exact same voice that says, oh yeah, you can drink two this time. It's different. Things have changed, right? Identical voice, right? And before you know it, I hadn't been to a meeting in a week, and then I haven't been to a meeting in a month, and I hadn't been to a meeting in 3 months, right? And I'm getting really, really dry, and I'm getting really, really thirsty, right? I haven't had a relapse with alcohol, but I can't say that I was in sobriety. I was in sobriety for sure, right? I was so dry, I was a fire hazard, you know? Keep open flames away from me, I'd burst. I got really, really, really sick, somewhere between 10 and 11 years. And I was writing tickets that my ego couldn't cash. You know, I was arrogant and I thought I was uppity. And I flew on this trip over to Europe and I alienated the captain so bad that he told me to sit down and shut up and keep my feet off the seats. That was right before he started making a mistake. And I saw that he was making a mistake. And I tried to tell him, hey, you're making a mistake. And he's like, I told you, shut up. And we, long story short, we nearly flew into the side of the Alps with over 400 people in the airplane. We crossed the Alps in a full stall in the 747. And for years, I blamed him. When the reality is, I need to blame myself because I violated the essence of the crew, made it to the point where he couldn't talk to me, right? So now I'm going to the NTSB and I got this massive hearing and the union's telling me to lie. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to lie. If they ask me what time it is, I'm not going to build them a clock, but I will not lie under any circumstance. You know, and I get up to the final hearing and my boss has already told me, you're getting fired today. If we can't figure out what really happened, you're getting terminated. And finally the truth came out and they finally admitted to the truth and they fired everybody except me. I was the only guy that kept my career because I told the truth. Another miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, just following the principles of the program, right? So what did I do? I almost broke my arm, patting myself on the back. Oh, Dave, what a great job you did, right? You'd think God would have gotten my attention, right? 4 days later, I get the phone call that nobody ever wants to get. Lieutenant Frederickson, you've been activated. I'm like, what? I'm a reservist. We don't go to war. What are you talking about? Activated. No, you're going to war, right? Off to Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I'm going to war, right? Hey, honey, I'm headed for war. I don't know when I'll be home. Love you. See you. Bye. Out the door I go. Now, one of the things Carl always taught me was always carry a big book and a 12 and 12. So one day we're flying into this place in Saudi Arabia and they're firing scuds. And the intelligence we have is that they're chemical scuds, right? And we're thinking, oh my God. Well, as a flight crew, the chem gear that we wear, it takes about 40 minutes to put on. You have to take your uniform off and put on a charcoal suit. Then you put your flight suit on and you got to tape the gloves and it's just long before. The guys on the ground, they carry this little mask on their hip. They whip it out and they can have their chem gear on literally about 30 seconds. With us, it takes quite a long time. And we only do it once a year. We practice that mop, they call it, once a year, right? And everybody on the crew is freaking out that we got to put our chem gear on, right? And I'm sitting there panicking with the rest of them. I'm like, oh, this is the real deal. This could get really ugly. And I didn't know what to do. And for the first time, I'd always been anonymous. First time in my life, I reached into my helmet bag and I pulled out my big book. When I opened up my big book, it fell open to the third step prayer. And I took the third step prayer, I believe, for the first time right there. I turned my will and life over to the care of God. And I said, God, if today's the day I'm going to die, so be it. I want your will more than my will, whatever that is. Now, I'm not stupid. I put on my chem gear, right? And thank God it turned out it was a false report and we ended up landing and everything worked out. And it's funny because we were so worried about that. About 3 months later, right as the war kicked off, the Army had orders to blow up any munitions depots that they could find. And they built this runway that was way up north, right on the border of Iraq. And I'm out there and you'd think in Saudi Arabia, the one place you're gonna be able to get gas is Saudi Arabia. Sometimes we'd wait 18 hours for fuel trucks in Saudi Arabia to bring us jet fuel so we could fly back out. And so we ran out of crew duty day, so we're gonna spend the night. And we had these containers, you know, and they put an air conditioning unit in the container and they had these bunk beds and that's where your quarters. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna go out for a run. And I'm out running, I run past the Brits and it's a joint use base and the British guys all have their chem gear on. And I run up to the British guy, I'm like, what are you guys doing, an exercise? He's like, no, our detectors went off. I was like, what do you mean your detector? Thanks for telling us, right? Everybody on my crew, we got gassed. The Army had blown up a depot. We were downwind, you know, and of course the military denied anything. They said, we don't know what's going on. And as a result, I've had five surgeries trying to repair the damage from getting gas. It wasn't until about 6 months ago we found out that it was sarin gas that was inside that depot that they blew up. And, you know, I have no animosity. You know, I have PTSD. Today I'm a disabled vet, you know. But once again, another miracle that I don't have any regret or resentment over that. It's just part of what happened to me. But that third step experience that I had, I realized I've been shortchanging the guys that I was working with. I would throw them a 12 and 12 because, you know, if you don't know where step one is in the big book, you're not going to find it, you know, just because it doesn't say step one is here, right? Whereas 12 and 12, the chapters are labeled, right? It's pretty easy to find. So when I came back to the United States, I had to go about and make amends. So I started and I wrote a whole new inventory. I started writing inventory again, went through all 12 steps formally again, got a new sponsor. Because what had happened was in the interim, my sponsor had died. I buried six sponsors in my life, right? I moved away from one. So I got one that's still alive. I still keep in touch with Kirby down in Florida. And then I just lost a sponsor about 6 months ago. And so Jack is my sponsor now. And let me tell you, that throws you for a loop. If you've never lost a sponsor, it'll shake you. You know, because it's your confidant, the person who knows everything about you. And all of a sudden they're gone. And you realize, wow, I have to choose somebody else. And I hadn't chosen anybody when I got activated for the Gulf War. Matter of fact, my friend Dave and I, we had this really sick relationship. We did that sort of co-sponsor thing where, you know, which really is code for, if you don't call me out, I won't call you out, you know, but we had a title. So in that case, I guess I had nine sponsors, but I don't really consider them a sponsor and because we didn't really do anything stepwise. But, you know, I went through the steps formally and I had to go back and make amends. And I take these guys through the big book, the way I had been given the gift from Carl. And they're like, oh, that was great. But that was so fast. Can you take me and a couple of my sponsees through? And I'm like, sure, no problem. And the next thing you know, I'm taking groups of three and then five and then 10. And then somebody says, hey, why don't you have a big book workshop? I'm like, all right. You know, and then we have 35 or 40 people. And then somebody records it. And once you get recorded, your life takes into a whole nother realm because then you end up on the speaking circuit. You know, and so I'm sort of doing big books workshops and get called and asked to go all over the place. And I don't know what possessed me, but at one of the workshops, I gave my email address and it got recorded on the cassette tapes. For young people, there were these little plastic things you'd have to stick into a machine, you know, and it was back then, it was the internet was brand new, it was AOL, you know, and I still have that AOL email address. Because all these years later, I get between 4 and 10 emails a month from people all over the world. They're listening to CDs or MP3s, or people are posting things on YouTube and they're like, hey, is this still a good email address? And I'll give it to you guys. It's aadave1@aol.com, right? I feel really sorry for AA Dave because people forget the one and he's getting all these bizarre emails, right? But those cassettes ended up in a hands of a guy in Chicago. And he called me one day and he says, hey, are you the guy I'm listening to on tape? And I said, probably. And he said, I need help. And he was a pilot. And he asked for help. And back then, calling on the telephone was really expensive long distance, right? It was so expensive that I ended up putting an 800 number into my house so that I could call my wife when I was anywhere in the country. And it worked out great because I took this guy through the 12 steps over the telephone. Never met him. Thank you. 15? Okay. I'm old. I can't see very well. I took him through the 12 steps over the telephone and he got sober and stayed sober for the rest of his life. You know, it was really kind of cool to see this occur. And I realized distance doesn't prevent you from being able to carry the message. You know, that was my first experience long distance. And I started taking people through the work on the telephone all over the place. Then the internet came out and then started using Skype. For you young people, it was a communication system like FaceTime, but it was on the internet. Back when you had the modems, it would go beep, beep, beep. Yeah, that's how old I am. So I would do Skype and then moved on to FaceTime. And now I do it on Zoom, you know. I run a steel on steel meeting. If you've never heard of steel on steel, it's an accountability meeting. We go through a series of questions. We challenge each other every single week on these questions. In my steel on steel group, there's guys from South Africa, all over Canada, Europe, and all over the United States. and we meet on Zoom. And half the group I had never met until about a month ago. I've been with these guys in Steel on Steel for years. I finally got asked to go speak up at a rehab near Toronto. Went up and met all my Canadian guys, you know, which really kind of cool because we know everything about each other. You know, we've been friends for years, and then walk up and it's like, dude, I didn't realize you were that short. And they're like, dude, I didn't know you were that tall. So it's really kind of cool how you can carry this message. And my life has taken on a flavor because you can't separate me from alcohol, right? And not include the life that has been built. AA is not something I do. It's something I live. It's an integral part of my life. I get up every morning and I do the same routine that I was taught all those years ago. I go through the big book and I do the 12 daily prayers. Anybody know that there's 12 prayers in the big book that we're supposed to do every day? What a shame. I'll send you a talk. I did an entire talk on the 12 daily prayers. Starts on page 84, right? It says, we ask each morning. I don't know how you read the book, but it says, we ask each morning that our creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. There's prayer number one. That prayer has changed my life more than any other prayer. Because I get up in the morning and I if I'm the tornado roaring through life, who's the first person I hit? It's my wife. So I ask God, help me to be patient, tolerant, kind, and loving towards her. And then anytime the big book says ask, it's a prayer, right? And if it gives you an assignment, like it says in meditation in that one, right? Meditation is to think about what does it look like to practice this, right? And when I think about it, I go, okay, patience, tolerance, kindness, love. My office, my desk sits this direction and there's a door to my right. And if I'm in my office and my wife walks into the office door, I call it the turret. I spin the turret and I'm getting ready to blast it. Like, why are you invading my private space, right? And what pops into my head is when I was impatient, intolerant, unkind, and unloving. So what I think about is, okay, instead of doing that behavior, what should I have done? So today, my meditation is as the turret is swinging to think, yeah, baby, what can I do for you? It's that simple. And it changed my marriage because instead of giving her the snarky attitude, like, yeah, what can I do for you? You know, I'm like actually excited to see her and say, yeah, honey, what can I do for you? What do you need? Right? One of my favorite expressions is what I want doesn't matter. I don't get a vote because I work for God today. I've got that laminated and it sits on my desk to remind me every single day that I don't get a vote. I get calls from guys that I sponsor, you know, and it's whatever the problem du jour is. You know, typically what they get back is, you know, they're complaining about life. And I say, did you happen to find a vote lying around your house this morning? I mean, what makes you think you get a vote today? You know, and they're like, oh, come on, Dave. You know, and then they'll say something stupid like, you know, my wife's really, really getting underneath my skin. And I'll say, well, what did God say about that? And I'll go, well, I haven't said my prayers yet. And I just, the next thing sound they're hearing is a dial tone. Bang, click. I don't want to talk to your disease. Go talk to God and then call me back. And of course, if I give you a resentment, column one, Dave, column two, hung up on me, right? There's a step for that. It's a wonderful thing. I'm more than happy to help them write inventory if it's about me. I laugh my butt off. We have a great time, right? So I carry the message a lot. And I go through the 12 daily prayers, right? Spot check inventory is prayer number two, right? We watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And then there's six items we're supposed to do when these crop up. It doesn't say if they crop up. It says when they crop up, right? There's a spot check inventory that we're supposed to do if we can catch it. Well, who does the watch? Did you ever think about that? You ever been getting really set to say something nasty, like when your wife walks into your office, you're going to say something nasty and that little still small voice says, don't say it? Where'd that voice come from? It's not my mind. My mind is thinking the nasty thought. But the don't say it came from somewhere else. I personally believe it's the spirit in my heart, right? And it doesn't use a megaphone. It uses a still small voice if I'm listening. So I get up every morning and on my second prayer and I say, you know, I ask that voice to get my attention so that I don't hurt people with selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Prayer number three is about carrying the vision of God's will into every one of our activities. I do that one. Prayer number four is the 12 daily questions. Now, there's only 11 questions there, but I break one of the questions in half. Love and tolerance, right? Because I can be, excuse me, kind and loving. I can be kind to you. I'm almost kind to everybody, but in my head, I might be thinking, what an ass, right? that's not loving. So I had to split that question, because if I was kind, I was answering yes. And in my heart of hearts, I knew I wasn't being loving to everybody I ran into. So now I have 12 questions, and I like the number 12. There's 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts, right? So I use 12 questions for my prayer number 4. And I go through all those prayers. The last prayer, from 83 to 88, there's 11 prayers, and then number 12 is on page 164, right? We ask God every day how we can help the man who's still sick. And I used to take this attitude that who am I going to call that's really sick? That's me up here and them down there. I'm looking down on them, right? They're the sick person. No. Who's the man who's still sick? Me. What am I going to do for me today first? I'm going to read something new. I'm going to read something spiritual. Right now I'm reading a book by Richard Rohr. I read Emmett Fox. I read all these spiritual people. So a lot of the old timers, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, rather. I read all those guys, you know, because I want to grow spiritually. And then I think, who haven't I seen in a meeting in a while? Don't forget about the old timers. Just because we've been around for decades, if you haven't seen us at a meeting, pick up the phone and give us a call and say, hey, Joe, where you been? You know, Marine Bob is a guy that I hadn't heard from in a couple months probably. I just reached out to Marine Bob and said, hey, Bob, where you been? He's got prostate cancer and pancreatic cancer, right? He really appreciated the call, you know? And I was just touching base to say, hey, man, I haven't seen you in a while. How are you doing? What's going on? And by sharing, where I was able to lighten the load a little bit, right? That's how cool this thing is. I have 2 babies that have never seen me drink. I don't know how much time I'm like that. 5? Okay. They've never seen me drink. Now, they haven't always seen me sober. They've seen me in sobriety, unfortunately. They've seen me throw temper tantrums. They've seen me tell somebody that they're number one out the window with my hand. You know, you guys don't do that here in New York, do you? I think that's where I learned it, was on Long Island. Hey, Dave, you're number one. You know, my youngest was probably 7 one day, and he looked at me and he said, Dad, can I have a big book? I said, big book? Sure. What do you need one for? He goes, I want you to highlight some of the prayers that you say every day. He wanted to get to know God better, right? We pray together. You know, I grew up literally in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to have a family. My father lived in California. My mother lived in New Jersey, and they stayed married. That was my example for how a marriage is supposed to work. Dysfunction Junction is my house, right? So how do you have a relationship? How do you raise a family? Well, 12 steps keep me sober, 12 traditions, right? It keeps the home group together. So in my family, we live on the 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts, and the 6 warranties, right? If you're at my house for any length of time, somebody will say, hey, I got a motion. Oh, we have a motion on the floor. Do I have a second? We have a second on the motion. Oh, you want to go to to Baskin Robbins for an ice cream? Can I have a second? You got a second? Okay. All opposed? And we all raise our hands, you know? And the group conscience speaks, and that's how we run the family, right? We have assignments. I am the chairman of the garbage committee. That is my committee. Garbage night is Tuesday night. They pick it up Wednesday morning. And my wife, that Al-Anon, sometimes she'll say, it's Thursday morning and the garbage cans are out at the curb. And I'm like, I have the right of decision and participation. I can bring those cans whenever I want, right? That's my committee. She's running the finance committee. I don't tell her how to pay the bills or how much money to save. It's none of my business, right? That's how we raised our family, right? We run a couples meeting. Anybody ever heard of a couples meeting? It's where you practice the 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts in your relationship, right? And we sit around and we talk about subjects, but you're not talking about how it applies to you. You're talking about how it applies to you as a couple. So how does a resentment affect you as a couple? How does it affect your communication? And we get down and dirty. We talk about really serious stuff. I've literally seen people, there's a couple there that's phenomenal. They were literally on their way to the divorce attorney and they swung by our couples meeting on the way to the divorce attorney, and they're still married today because they applied the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts to the relationship. Folks, this stuff works. And one of the greatest gifts that I've ever gotten in my life is carrying the message. You know, when I got sober, Carl used to say, sit up front with the dummies, right? And today we don't get wet drunks a lot. You know, when I got sober, there was fist fights and there was brawls and it was crazy. You know, and you'd bring the wet drunk in up front and he'd sit in the front row. And so I always had to sit next to him, and Carl always sat behind me, you know. And if it was a you'd have to raise your hand in order to speak. And I'd raise my hand and Carl would grab my arm and pull it down behind me. Don't spread your disease around here, dummy. Like, oh. Right. I can remember the first time that he didn't pull my arm down. And I was like, wow, that's something. He actually thinks I have some experience. He didn't stop pulling my arm down until I finished my events. Because then he said I had some experience to share. Right? He didn't want me sharing what my ideas and my opinions were. He said opinions will kill people. Experience doesn't kill somebody. You always talk about the book or your own personal experience with the book. And that way people will live. It's like, wow, that makes sense. If you haven't carried the message to another person, do not shortchange yourself. There is nothing cooler on the planet than seeing somebody that's shaking and baking and they're chirping like a squirrel, right? And they're just falling apart. And you take them through the 12 steps and you watch them recover and their life changes right before their eyes. And you get a front row seat to that show. It is the greatest show on the planet. Do I get 2 minutes left? Perfect. 2010, I'm on a layover in London, England. And I walk out of the hotel, and it's one of those beautiful days. It snowed, and the whole city shuts down when it snows. They don't have to handle snow in London. And the sky was just starting to break up a few little holes, and the beams of sunlight were coming down, and there was beautiful snow stuck to the side of this church spire. And I'm like, that would be an awesome picture. I'm looking up at the picture, and I swing around the corner, and there's black ice. The snow had melted and refrozen, and I hit the black ice, and I slipped and fell. And I'm embarrassed to say that after 20 years of martial arts, I did not do a good break fall, but I did break something. I broke my back. Didn't know I broke my back, but I broke my back. And long story short is I ended up with severe nerve damage. And I remember when I came to, the doctor had tears in his eyes and he looked at me and he said, your flying days are over. You're never gonna fly again. He said, I'm just hoping I can get you to walk again. And what flashed in my mind was Carl talking to me when I was very newly sober. And he said, you know, the Oxford group had a principle. It came right out of the Bible. It was Matthew 6:33. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all else shall be added unto you. He said, that is the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous in one sentence. Seek God, do the next right thing, and don't worry about anything else but fixed. And I looked the doctor straight in the eye, and he said, Doc, you don't know my God. I will fly again. I was disabled. I couldn't go upstairs. I was walking with two canes in excruciating pain. Every single day, and I would not take painkillers. I danced with that devil, and I said, I will never get addicted to opium ever again. You know, I had enough black tar in my life that I said, duh, I'm not touching this stuff. I used meditation and prayer. Every single day, the survival school in the military got me through because they said, you'll never get tortured when you're a POW where they'll let you have a clock because they want temporal distortion. They don't want you to know what time it is. It says, if you're lucky enough to have a clock, you can survive anything for 60 seconds. And I literally, for days and weeks and months, would watch the second hand and they'd say, for this next minute, I'm just not going to kill myself. If I get one more minute, God, get me through this. I broke it down to the minute and I survived. And then one day I'm getting wheeled in for surgery and the doc says, hey, there's this weird thing. I was reading the AMA. He says, you know, these people in the old folks home, they're all depressed. He says, they found that they put them on these antidepressants. This one antidepressant, people that have diabetic nerve pain in their feet, it clears up their nerve pain. He goes, you want to try it? And I said, Doc, what the hell do I have to? Sure, of course I'm going to try it. Every day it felt like somebody was sticking a red hot poker up the bottom of my feet, day and night. It was a living hell. 24 hours later, the pain was gone from this nerve pain. It was a miracle drug. It works like a charm. I took it for exactly 7 days. And then I started to rebuild my body because all my muscles had atrophied. 4 years, 11 months, and 2 weeks later, I got my medical back, and I'm back flying airplanes. God gave me my medical back. But let me tell you what happened in that time period. Because I wasn't working, when GSO called me and said, hey, could you come to Russia and teach the traditions and concepts for the GSO in Russia? I had the time to go do that and do a big book workshop in Moscow and carry the message. And a Ukrainian kid, Nick, translated everything into Russian. So they now have a copy of the big book workshops and all the traditions and concepts in Russian. I wrote a big book study guide, and one for the traditions, one for the concepts, and they translated the whole thing for me. My brother, don't clap for me, that's God. That's God. It's a miracle. You know, this kid reaches out to me and says, hey, can I translate this stuff to Russian? The next thing I'm in Moscow and I've got all the equipment that I need to teach the Russians in Russian. I mean, how does that happen, right? My brother Don, he gets a very unique form of cancer. He's like 30 years sober. And I had the time to go to California and nurse him until he died.
And he died 35 years sober. But I had the time to do it. At the time, I was walking around thinking, poor me. I can't fly airplanes. I had this beautiful life, and it was taken away from me. And here, these cool experiences are happening that I wouldn't have done if God hadn't taken that away. What a gift. Anytime something bad happens to you, look in the ashes. There's a jewel in the mud there. There's a phoenix that's going to come out of those ashes. There's a silver lining if you just bother to look. I call that a postmortem, right? About 3 weeks ago, I got a brand new puppy. You know, 9/11, or excuse me, COVID, my son is disabled. He got Lyme disease and he's permanently disabled. So I got him a service dog. When COVID happened, he came home from college and the service dog got really depressed. She couldn't work because she was going everywhere with him and now nobody's going anywhere. So I had to get a puppy. So my service dog needed a service dog. So we got Daisy, right? Well, COVID restrictions lift and now my son's taking his service dog. He's taking Tess out with him. And now Daisy's at the door like, why can't I go with you guys? So we got Honey. So my service dog's service dog has a service dog. So Tess can go out and Honey and Daisy will stay home. Well, Honey doesn't like to go to bed at night. So she was trying to run away from me and I bent forward and I tried to push her into the mudroom and I did a forward bending twisting motion and I popped my back. That's why I had surgery 3 days or 2 days ago on my back, right? The same day that I blew out my back, I found out I got awarded the highest award you can get in my career as a wide body captain. Only I live in Texas and I got my job out of Kennedy Airport. So I brought my wife with me on this trip and we're looking for areas because I'm gonna have to come back to the New York area to live, right? So I'm gonna be back in this area. Why do I tell that story? Because it's just a bump in the road. Life is gonna happen to you. You know, after 9/11, I volunteered to become a federal marshal. I had to tell the truth. Yep, thank you. This will be the last story, and I'll shut up. I had to tell the truth on another form, right? And one of the things that happened to me was I'd gotten this phone call about 15 years ago, and it was a guy, he calls me up and says, hey, another one of those phone calls. Hey, are you the guy we're talking to, listen to on tape? And I said, probably. He says, well, hey, I'm in senior management for your airline. I want you to come take over a drug and alcohol program. And I said, okay, I had been raised in that. My dad was doing that with Eastern Airlines. And so I went and did it for my airline. And in that process, I started teaching the FAA drug and alcohol school. And I've been an interventionist for 35 years and I'm a national certified addictions counselor. I got all these little initials behind my name. And I literally wrote the book on the subject for how to recertify pilots, right? And I got the absolute honor and gift of helping the Air Force and about, I think, 17 different airlines set up their drug and alcohol programs, right? So I go to become a federal officer and the psychiatrist is looking at me. He's reading my description and it says marijuana, yes, cocaine, yes, heroin, yes. And looks over his glasses and he goes, you look familiar. And I said, yeah, I did your FAA drug and alcohol school. He goes, oh, yeah, I remember you now. He goes, sure, I'll give you a gun. Now tell me your story. My interview was me telling my story of the power of God. How does a 5-time convicted drug dealer become a military officer with a security clearance, and now I'm a federal officer, and I carry a gun when I fly. I mean, only if God says you're going to Nineveh, you're going to Nineveh. He'll take you places you can't possibly imagine. If I had thought what was the best thing that could ever happen to me, I would have shortchanged myself. I stand before you, one of the luckiest men on the planet, right? I get up every single morning, and I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and I say, God, what do you got for me today? What I want doesn't matter. I don't get a vote because I work for you today. Right? And I spend my entire day trying to make the world a better place because I'm in it and I'm sober. So my charge to each and every one of you tonight is that when you see some worker here at the hotel and they're serving you, thank them. Look them in the eye. Read their name tag and say, hey, Sue, how are you doing today? And she says, oh, I'm doing all right. And she said, no, really, how are you doing today? I did that with a woman at 7-Eleven once, and she looked at me with tears in her eyes because people just don't do that. And she said, are you in some kind of a 12-step program or something? I go, yeah. She says, hey, would you talk to my brother? He's got a really bad alcohol problem, alcohol and drugs. And I said, absolutely. It turned into a 12-step call, right? You never know where God's going to take you and who you're going to touch. So each and every one of you can change the world. How many Al-Anons do I got in the room? Why is every hand in the room not up? If you're going to be an effective sponsor, let me tell you, you're going to need Al-Anon. Otherwise, you're going to care more about your sponsee sobriety than they do. But you got to have be able, you're going to learn. I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I learned how to grow up in Al-Anon, where they taught me the three C's and the four M's and how to detach with love, all the skill sets you're going to need, especially if you're in a relationship. You desperately need Al-Anon, right? I can't pitch it enough. It's a life changer. If you have any questions for me, you've got my email address, reach out to me. I've done dozens and dozens of talks. I did a talk for a guy in Africa, 350 miles is the closest AA meeting, but he had internet access. So I wrote an entire big book workshop for the guy. I did a PowerPoint presentation where I used my own inventory that I write inventory every 6 months. I used it in the PowerPoint presentation. I wrote a study guide. So he's got the study guide, a big book, the recordings, and the PowerPoint presentation. He can take himself through the 12 steps. He's still sober today. Don't be surprised who you're going to be able to touch. So I can send you that workshop if you're interested in it. If you don't have somebody here that can carry the message to you, I'll carry the message to you on audio. God help you, because you'll be stuck listening to me. But you know, some if you're desperate enough, you'll do it. I love each and every one of you. I thank you and the committee for everything they did, for giving me the absolute honor of being here. And I love each and every one of you, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Go with God. Appreciate it.